Good morning. This is the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The following program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin, and we're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, August the 14th, 2019. We begin with the indie voices. This week, Slap Happy by Greg Doucette. In North Carolina, sharing your hashtag MeToo story could land you in court. Since the hashtag MeToo movement went viral in late 2017, a number of once powerful celebrities have become synonymous with sexual abuse. Harvey Weinstein, Bill Cosby, R. Kelly, Matt Lauer, etc. A once powerful celebrity you might not immediately recognize is Victor Mignogna, Vic to his rabid fans. Mignogna is a former star in the anime industry, known for providing the voice of popular characters in the Full Metal Alchemist and Dragon Ball franchises. And like many of those hashtag MeToo household names, Mignogna was called out for spending the better part of two decades sexually harassing a number of women and girls, including two of his co-workers. A fallout of his exposure was swift. Mignogna was dropped from one production company, then by another, as more women shared their stories about him on social media. But then Mignogna took a different approach than the men before him. He filed a defamation lawsuit against his victims in Texas, claiming his accusers damaged his reputation by describing their abuses at his hands. This sort of tactic, attempting to silence someone by suing them, is known as a strategic lawsuit against public participation. SLAPs use civil litigation to intimidate critics by sapping their time, money, and morale. And the use of slaps has grown alongside the growth of social media. Just in the last year, a doctor sued a patient in New York for $1 million after the woman left a negative review on Yelp. A Missouri man was sued for leaving a 3-star TripAdvisor review of a theme park he visited. And a South Carolina restaurant sued a customer after she posted a Facebook that the restaurant's new management would not honor the owner's coupons. But slap suits are particularly vexatious when they are against the victims of sexual assault. Consider the case of Megan, not her real name, a woman I represented a few years ago. Megan was a member of a local organization in which one of the group's leaders, Lawrence, came up behind her, reached his arms around her torso, and squeezed both of her breasts. Although Megan never called the police, she notified the other leaders in the organization. Lawrence was expelled. He then filed a lawsuit against the organization's other leaders for expelling him, and against Megan for defaming him. Megan had to find an attorney and endure nearly a year of litigation, including answering invasive discovery questions and sitting through a day-long deposition where she was forced to answer still more invasive questions on camera. She won later that year. Lawrence's lawsuit was rejected, but not before Megan had to repeatedly relive the trauma of being attacked. Vic Mignogna's accusers have an advantage that Megan did not. Texas is one of 29 states to enact state laws to punish the use of slaps, known as anti-slap statutes. The Texas Citizens Participation Act provides for an expedited review of slap suits, empowering the court to dismiss them in as little as 2 months after filing. More importantly, Texas anti-slap statute requires a judge to levy sanctions on any plaintiff filing a bumptious slap suit in an amount sufficient to deter the party from bringing similar actions in the future, plus forcing them to pay the victim's attorney fees, court costs, and all other expenses incurred to defend themselves. Any slaps are a vital tool to protect the First Amendment rights of victims. And robust versions have been enacted in states as red as Texas and as blue as California. Even several of our neighboring states use them. Georgia's 1996 anti-slap statute was substantially expanded in 2016, and Tennessee's first meaningful anti-slap statute went into effect last month. But for Tar Heels like Megan, our legislatures have offered them no protection at all, whatsoever. Our politicians dawdle while assault victims get slapped in court, and the continued legislative inaction is inexcusable. Now from the soapboxer, the R word. For Trump supporters, admitting his racism would mean admitting an uncomfortable truth about themselves. The week after Donald Trump launched his racist attack on U.S. Representative Elijah Cummings, which came on the heels of his racist attacks on four non-white Democratic members of Congress, the News and Observer gave resident MAGA apologist J. Petter Zeihan, Inc., to argue that the president and his Republican Party are not, in fact, racist, but rather the victims of a false narrative painted by Democrats who are the real racists. While Trump may have been insensitive in calling a mostly black congressional district with a median income above the national average a disgusting rat and rodent infested mess, Zeihan tells us, a fair-minded person, while hoping that the president would be more precise, should see that he is not a racist. 3 days later, a Trump-loving white nationalist murdered 22 people in El Paso Walmart after posting a manifesto explaining, in language that uncannily mirrored Trump's immigration rhetoric, that he was fighting an invasion. Funny how the racists think Trump is one of them. Lots of paper have third-tier hacks like Zeihan, men, always men, who crib their sophomoric understanding of U.S. history from low-rent hucksters like Dinesh D'Souza and regurgitate the outrage du jour from the Fox News talk radio set. These columns tend to land somewhere between intellectually vapid and irresponsibly dishonest. Papers publish them as a fig leaf to the MAGA crowd, an effort to assure them that they're not part of the liberal media. Like most, Zeihan is rarely worth rebutting. Here, however, he's recycling an argument common among Trump acolytes, which, in light of El Paso, warrants some scrutiny. His point is this: Republicans should ignore Democratic liberals, the media, when they say Trump is racist, because Democrats, liberals, the media, always say Republicans are racist. As Zeihan puts it, before Trump, Democrats leveled the same despicable smear against Mitt Romney, Vice President Joe Biden warned. African Americans that Romney would put y'all back in chains. Not to be pedantic, but Biden said Romney's policies would allow big banks to do so. Before that, Zeihan continues, they called John McCain racist and George W. Bush racist, and so it goes with most every Republican back to Richard Nixon. Quick history. Whatever Nixon's personal feelings, he really didn't like Jews, for your information. Beginning with his 1968 campaign, racial appeals became central to GOP politics. See, for instance, Republican operative Lee Atwater's infamous quote, "You start out in 1954 by saying nigger, nigger, nigger. By 1968, you can't say nigger. That hurts you, and it backfires. So you say stuff like forced busing, states' rights, and all that stuff, and you're getting so abstract. Now, you're talking about cutting back taxes, and all these things you're talking about are totally economic things, and a byproduct of them is blacks got hurt worse than whites," end quote. Ronald Reagan denounced mythical welfare queens. George W. H. Bush ran the Willie Horton ad. George W. Bush's campaign smeared John McCain with rumors about his adopted black child. McCain elevated Sarah Palin to the national stage, where she accused the first black majority party presidential nominee of palling around with terrorists. Romney kissed Donald Trump's ring while Trump was pushing the racist birther effort. Trump launched his presidential campaign by calling Mexican immigrants rapists and pledging to ban Muslims. What Zane doesn't consider is that GOP leaders have been accused of racism because they've employed racism to win votes. Trump has been accused of racism more frequently because he says and does overtly racial things more frequently. Indeed, Trump's entire political career has been built on racial demagoguery, and numerous studies suggest that he owes his victory in 2016 in part to his voters' racial attitudes. But for his supporters to admit that would mean admitting an uncomfortable truth about themselves. So instead, they define the R word so narrowly as to render it meaningless. Truth be told, however, I'm less interested in what the J. Petter Zanes of the world tell themselves about Donald Trump's racism than in the effects their denial has on the rest of us. It's no surprise, for instance, that Republicans don't want to talk about guns after El Paso. More unnerving has been their widespread reluctance to acknowledge the crisis of the increasingly violent white supremacist movement in the Trump era. As a former FBI supervisor who oversaw terrorism cases told the Washington Post, quote, "I think in many ways the FBI is hamstrung in trying to investigate the white supremacist movement like the old FBI would. There's some reluctance among agents to bring forth an investigation that targets what the president perceives as his base," end quote. And if we can't even address white terrorism without offending Trump supporters, how can we possibly begin to address complex systemic issues of racial and social justice, wealth gaps, education gaps, opportunity gaps, affordability crises, etc.? The thing about Trump is that he says the quiet parts loud, often through a megaphone. He's fundamentally incapable of hiding who he is, and that makes the choice ahead of us crystal clear. Between now and Election Day, we as a country will have to confront a lot of uncomfortable truths about who we are and who we're going to be. The next article, The Master Builder. Phil Freelon's works will inspire generations not yet born. But his most important monument is his family. On the evening of July 31st, Pierce Freelon took the stage at the Haiti Heritage Center during a spoken word concert in memory of his father, the celebrated Durham architect Phil Freelon, who died on July 9th after a 3-year struggle with ALS. He was 66. Pierce was joined by Nyenya Freelon, who is his mother and Phil's wife of 40 years. Though regal as always, wearing a navy blue African dress, Nyenya, a 6-time Grammy nominee, appeared tentative until she began to sing. "I told Jesus it would be all right if he changed my name." She started the song in an almost conversational tone that increased in intensity each time she repeated the line, "I told Jesus it would be all right if he changed my name." At times her voice would soar up to stirring heights, then drop down into a dark, lonely place that spoke of a deep hurt. "I told Jesus it would be all right if he changed my name." Then her singing gave way to a low, soulful moan while her son spoke about God being a strong black woman. Before leaving the stage, Nyenya looked upward and stretched her beaming face and opened hands to the heavens. In the African-American tradition, we say, everybody goodbye, ain't gone, Nina says, adding that the veil between the world of the living and the ancestors is thin, and that we allow our loved ones to live on by continuing their body of work and spirit. Nina says that her youngest son, Pierce, last week announced that he is running for North Carolina State Senate, has vowed to continue his father's good works and service. Phil was still alive when Nina decided she was going to perform at the concert. In the days after his passing, she struggled with that decision. It was a chance to step my toe into the waters of a public expression, she said. It was good for me, and good for the public to see what grief looked like in that moment. I chose that song because there are a couple of times in life that changes your name. When we get married, when we have children, and when we lose someone. To go from wife to widow, or husband to widower. I was seeking inside that song the spiritual strength to bear that name change. Yesterday was a good day for her, Pierce says, the next day, sitting in a conference room at Black Space in Durham, a youth arts venture he founded. She was uncertain as to whether or not she would be able to perform, and then it ended up being a very healing moment for her. Grief can take a lot of different forms, and for her family, art is a tool to process and heal. It's apt that the event was held at Hyde, an African-American cultural center that was formerly St. Joseph Church. Pierce says the connection between art, faith, and worship was the reason why his parents transformed a Gothic revival church in Old North Durham, which was once served parishioners with hearing impairments, into North Star Church of the Arts earlier this year. More than just a venue, North Star is a sanctuary that recognizes the sacred bond between art and spirituality. Phil said, if you want something, you have to give the same thing. If you want love, you have to give love. If you want peace, you have to give peace. If you want healing, you have to give healing. And first and foremost, Phil Freelon was an artist. The tall, patrician, athletic, and soft-spoken man used a drafting table and a pen to create a legacy of public buildings that will inspire generations not yet born, most notably by leading the design team of the National Museum of African American History in Washington, D.C. But what he built in his family and in Durham is just as important as what he built for the world. Pierce would tell you that his dad's legacy is so much bigger than any building he designed. Pierce grew up in a home saturated with black music. His father loved James Brown, Earth, Wind, and Fire, Tower of Power, and Sly and the Family Stone. At home, as in the world, he built. There's a saying around the house that he can fix anything, Pierce said. He would dismantle and put bikes together. He liked the challenge of figuring out how it worked. He didn't like instructions and manuals. I think that was part of how he viewed the world, and that was ingrained in his parenting style. Pierce remembers when he was 16 years old and wanted to get ear piercings and a tattoo. His uncle and his cousins had tattoos, so it wasn't unheard of. He didn't say no, Pierce said. He offered me an alternative. He said, if you wait until you're 21, I'll get one with you, and I'll pay for it. But I'll bet that in waiting, you'll find that whatever you want to put on your body right now won't be the same when these things are permanent. As soon as I turned 18, I wouldn't have needed his permission. But the prospect of him getting a tattoo was an offer I couldn't refuse. He was putting up the canvas of his body as collateral. On my 21st birthday, Pierce continues, I told him, Dad, I have no idea what I wanted on my arm at 16. It was probably some barbed wire or snake. Whatever it was, I don't want it anymore. So you got me. The lesson around permanence has been ingrained. Leading by example was Phil Freelon's favorite form of guidance and discipline. Whenever Pierce or his siblings misbehaved, he would remind them, "Freelons don't do that," powerfully invoking a community of ancestors who were outraged by your shenanigans. There is Phil Freelon, the person, the human, the drummer, the photographer, the father, the husband, says Pierce, who was holding his father's hand when he died. That is the pyramid, the monument, the obelisk of his legacy. Phil Freelon was born and raised in Philadelphia. The home he shared with his parents and siblings was filled with art. His grandfather, Alan Randall Freelon, was an impressionist painter during the Harlem Renaissance, and his grandchildren regularly visited his studio. Freelon's parents noticed his interest in drawing and assembling things and encouraged it. His father was a traveling salesman for a medical equipment company. He would come back with a model of a car that I would assemble, or a battleship, or even things that required more creativity and imagination, Freelon said in a 2017 North Carolina State University Library's oral history about him that provides quotes for this story. He said, "I was fortunate to be in a family where I was surrounded by the arts and was able to be inspired by that." Freelon attended Central High School in Philadelphia, a public school focused on the arts that attracted drawing students from all over the city. He took classes in design art, drafting, and realized he was drawn to architecture and decided to become an architect. He enrolled at Hampton Institute, now Hampton University, a historically black school after high school. It was the 1960s. The civil rights movement, along with growing assertions of black power and black pride, were at a high point. There was pride in heritage in the 1960s. Not it wasn't there before, Freelon said, but it was the black power movement, the music, the clothing. I wore an afro. In some ways, we are in a similar time period now with a heightened awareness of racial tension and inequity. Hampton had an accredited architectural program, and Freelon finally met a real architect, Liberian-born John Henry Spencer, who was chairman of the department. Freelon, barely into his sophomore year, was absolutely already tutoring fifth-year students, and the college professor took the unusual and unselfish step of encouraging Freelon to transfer to a bigger school after observing his drafting skills. Freelon transferred to North Carolina State, where he took graduate-level courses as an undergraduate and received the school's top design award in 1975 while he earned his degree. Then he earned a master's degree in architecture from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in 1977. Nyanya was in Cambridge at the same time, studying at Simmons College, but the two did not meet until they were both in North Carolina. It turned out that the future couple had mutual friends, a married couple who were living in the Triangle. It was on their friend's front porch on July 7, 1978, that they first met. They talked all night. Phil told Nyanya he wanted to be a father. "It could have been a deal-breaker," says Nyanya, who was 22 at the time. The young architect told her about his own father being a great dad and memories of him riding on his shoulders, being lavished with love and attention. "He wanted that," Nyanya said. "He was the best dad and a fun dad. All three of our children have that shine because of a dad who loved them." Nyanya says she and her husband were like a key in a lock when they met. "It's like we were destined." At the time, Nyanya had no intention of pursuing the singing career that would eventually bring her 6 Grammy nominations. She was eyeing instead a career as a public health administrator. But she says, Phil encouraged her in a way that wasn't in words only. It was love in action. There was no question in his mind that I would achieve what I needed to achieve in my life, she said. People ask, what is your secret? My secret is, marry well. Don't be with someone who whispers doubt in your life. 1 year later, in October of 1979, they were married. Pierce said his parents' marriage was one of purpose. They met in 78, married in 79, had Dean in 80, Maya in 81, and me in 82. They just hit the ground running. Freeland returned to the Triangle in 1978 to work with Durham architect John Latimer and landed a job teaching at his alma mater School of Design. He enjoyed teaching and applied for a full-time tenured position in 1980, but he was not offered tenure-track position, and the school officials did not give him an acceptable answer, he said, for not hiring him to teach full-time. I left in disgust, says Freelon, who late added that the School of Design still has a dearth of black faculty members more than 35 years later. Freelon accepted a job offer with 3D International, a large architectural firm in Houston, where he and his wife's first two children were born. In 1982, John Atkins, who had worked with Freelon at Latimer, asked him if he wanted to return to North Carolina to work with O'Brien Atkins, a firm he had started 7 years before with Bill O'Brien. At first, Freelon declined, but had started a conversation with his wife about concerns over raising a family in a large city. He called Atkins back a month later and took the job. During his seven-year stint with the firm, Freelon was named a vice president and helped it grow from 30 members to 150. In 1989, at the age of 35, Freelon applied for a prestigious Loeb Fellowship at Harvard. Nina was just starting her singing career and had accepted a visiting artist position at Brunswick County with the North Carolina Arts Council. It was tremendous, Freelon said. She got to sing for the first time, and her youngest had just started kindergarten. We lived on a beach for a year. In late 1989, Freelon decided to leave O'Brien Atkins and start his own firm. Nina and I were like, let's go for it, he said. She didn't hesitate. She said, yeah, let's do this. We were willing to cut back on some things, and she was starting to earn some income for her singing, and I was confident we would not be in the deficit for long. I was confident in my ability to grow and cultivate the practice, and that happened very quickly. Pierce remembers the change in family dynamics when his mom signed a recording contract with a major label, Columbia Records, in 1992. Dad told her, do what you love. She made the bold choice to step into music, and we see how that story is going, Pierce said, who is also a musician, with projects such as hip-hop jazz band The Beast. They worked together to lift each other up. Mom in the 80s was singing at Haiti and Bembe and learning the American songbook. By 1990, my dad had started his architectural firm, and in 1992, my mom had signed and was going on world tours. We would eat beef enchiladas every day while she was gone because Dad only knew two or three recipes. She was working, and we were cheering her on. They kept climbing together. In 2014, the Freelon Group was a 60-member firm when it was acquired by Perkins & Will, a global architectural firm. Dad's favorite quote was, architecture is frozen music, and it made complete sense, Pierce said. My dad was frozen music. Mom is fluid music. Same source material, water, in different phases. Housed at North Carolina State's Library Special Collections section, the Phil Freelon Papers, 1975 to 2018, contains his architectural drawings, voluminous project files, and architectural records that document his work in his area, including Hillside High School, the Diamond View Office Building, the Durham Bulls Athletic Park, the Durham Police Department, the East Terminal of Raleigh-Durham International Airport, Hope Valley Elementary, the Hill Center, and others. The Durham Bulls Athletic Park is one of the first really memorable buildings that my dad created, Tier said. I have so many fond memories of that structure, so many foul balls, so many little kids scrambling to try and catch them, so many mouthfuls of cotton candy, so many songs and chants and laughter and cheers and fun and pride. He is responsible for so much of that. The ease with which you get in a building, the concession stands, everything, the spirit of it. His soul is in that structure, and how about that? The collection also chronicles work that Freeland designed throughout North Carolina and the United States, including college buildings, libraries, cultural arts centers, and historic parks. The one thing that Phil Freeland didn't build, though, were prisons. Those dismal industrial structures, which are little more than landlocked slave ships in this era of mass incarceration. Those kinds of complexes stand in stark contrast to his life-affirming designs. And believe me, there is lots of money in designing prisons, Nina said. He really, really believed people deserve beautiful spaces to be in, light and airy space, and should say, welcome. In 2017, when Fast Company named Freeland its Architect of the Year, writer Diana Budge described him as the designer of nearly every major museum or public space dedicated to black culture in the United States, the National Center for Civil and Human Rights in Atlanta, the Museum of the African Diaspora in San Francisco, the Motown Museum in Detroit, and the Mississippi Civil Rights Museum in Jackson. Those museums are akin to modern-day pyramids that pay tribute to African Americans and others who struggled and sometimes gave their lives to move this country forward. In downtown Atlanta, the National Center for Civil and Human Rights exterior presented two multi-shaded walls that curve inward toward each other. The design symbolizes the link that connect and empower disparate individuals and groups. Tori Shepherd, a center spokeswoman, told the Indy that the design reminds her of a woman's hands, and its earth-tone shadings represent the women of the world. It shows the power of people and what we can accomplish when we stick together, she said. Unquestionably, Freeland's masterpiece is the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture, located on the National Mall, just across from the Washington Monument. The monument was first proposed by black Civil War veterans more than 100 years ago. The building's design was inspired by the three-tiered corona used in Yoruban art by the Nigerian people of West Africa. 250,000 square feet of surface presents a latticework fashion from bronze-colored Schumann panels that recall the bronze art of the ancient Benin Empire and the ironworks created by African Americans throughout the South. A tour of the museum beckons visitors on a journey of historic galleries and exhibits that tell a vast story of African American slavery and freedom, struggle and resistance, ingenuity and achievement. Phil Freeland was a pole vaulter and herder in high school. He ran 5 miles each day as an adult. Then his run began to slow. His right ankle started bothering him. Following a battery of medical tests, he was diagnosed with ALS in March of 2016, 6 months before his Smithsonian Museum officially opened. I'm like, are you kidding? That can't be the truth, Nina remembers thinking. The couple looked for alternative treatments. Freeland underwent medical trials at the Duke ALS Clinic, which seemed promising. But the illness grew worse as he lost the ability to walk, speak, and swallow. Yenya remembers the transitions he was forced to make from cane to walker, scooter to wheelchair, finally needing a breathing device and neck brace. She said her husband's decision to join his ancestors came when the doctor said they could extend his life with the use of a feeding tube after he was no longer able to swallow. We said, no, he did not want that. Shortly before his dad died, Pierce got a tattoo. He rolled up his left sleeve to display a three-dimensional pyramid. That's my dad's first logo of the Freelon Group, 1990, he said. He was here when I got it. He loved it. He said, it looks good. I told him, I know it looks good. You designed it. When Pierce was a kid, he thought the symbol was merely a triangle. But before his father died, he explained to his son that the pyramids are of African origins, and the ancient structure speaks to the African origins of a science, mathematics, and architecture. Pierce's discovery is a fitting code for his father's legacy. In 2003, when Phil delivered the commencement address for the North Carolina State College of Design, he told the graduates, I want to first say that we are designers. In my view, design is not only a process and a way of thinking, it is a way of life. And now our next section, Sacred Ground. The drive to preserve Nina Simone's childhood home in Tryon brings a bounty of art to the triangle. One morning in June of 2018, Yolanda Rabin parked her car at 30 East Livingston Street in Tryon, North Carolina, where a modest clapboard house sits on a grassy slope. She didn't know why she'd been asked to come and sing on the porch of a jazz great Nina Simone's childhood home, but Rabin, a touring musician, who also works as a corporate attorney at IBM, wasn't about to pass up a chance. This, after all, was the very home where Simone, the daughter of a Methodist minister and the sixth of eight children, was born Eunice Kathleen Wayman in 1933, and where it became apparent, even before the age of three, that she had a prodigious gift for music, that she was, in her older brother's terms, words, a genius. Inside, the house was in disrepair. The ceiling crumbling, the floorboards moldering, the rooms mostly empty. Nevertheless, the structure was still standing. When I walked in, I knew this is exactly where I'm supposed to be, Rabin said. Organizers from the North Carolina Arts Council revealed the occasion that Rabin, along with three other African-American musicians from North Carolina, had been asked to sing for a surprise press conference announcing that the house had been designated as a national treasure by the National Trust for Historic Preservation. This was a big deal. Fewer than 100 sites in the U.S. hold that title. The announcement, incidentally, was held on Juneteenth, the day that marks the emancipation of enslaved African Americans. They're always talking about preserving folks' homes, but you never hear about black people being honored for what they stood for, Rabin said. That they chose Nina Simone, who fought all her life, that's very important. The announcement held a particular significance for Rabin. Like Simone, she is a jazz musician and comes from a family of preachers. She has also spent a lot of time trying to get into Simone's head. In 2012, she starred in Durham playwright Howard Croft's one-person play, Nina Simone, What More Can I Say? It was a role that she will reprise later this month in a new version of the show at Playmakers' PRC2 series. At the press conference, when Rabin got up to sing, she could feel the eyes of one particular audience member trained on her. When I finished, I came down the steps and she touched me, and she was like, baby, Rubin says, and then she told me who she was, and oh, I melted. Not only am I at Nina Simone's house singing in honor of her, but now I'm meeting her blood. It was Nina Simone's younger sister, Frances Wayman Fox. The effort to preserve Simone's Tryon home has a long, winding history, but perhaps it's best to begin at noting how remarkable it is that the house is still standing at all. Built around 1930, the three-room, 660-square-foot house is the kind of threadbare construction battered by southern storms that often blends into the back roads, or otherwise disappears entirely. If you go searching for the childhood homes of many other African-American artists and activists of the 20th century, like W.E.B. Du Bois, Rosa Parks, Malcolm X, you'll find only a placard on a street corner. That Simone's house has survived time and gentrification, a curtain of kudzu spreading it, separating it from a panorama of the foothills and distant Hogback Mountains, well, that feels close to a miracle. Over the years, the house has passed through many hands and rehabilitation attempts in 1916 and went on the market, putting it in immediate danger of being destroyed. In 2017, four African-American visual artists from New York, the conceptual artist Adam Pendleton, the collagist and filmmaker Ellen Gallagher, and abstract painter Julie Mara, too, and the sculptor and painter Rashid Johnson, quietly purchased the property for $95,000. Their timing couldn't have been better. That same year, the National Trust for Historic Preservation lost a campaign. Within the help of the trust, Pendleton, Gallagher, Matreda, and Johnson were able to secure the house's national treasure status, protecting it from demolition. It was really perfect timing. I truly believe that everything happens for a reason, says Carly Jones, the music director at the North Carolina Arts Council, noting that last year Governor Roy Cooper declared 2019 the year of music, rolling out Come Here, NC, a year-long series celebrating North Carolina's musical heritage. Numerous arms at the state's capital of natural and cultural resources have been involved in the preservation efforts since then, including the African American Heritage Commission, the North Carolina Arts Council, and the North Carolina Museum of Arts. The Tryon-based Nina Simone Project has also had a heavy hand. This collaboration, according to Jones, is a model for state and federal cultural programming. I think it is really important for North Carolina to be an example of how to be a good partner for this national campaign, to preserve spaces that belong to African Americans, she said. Providence may mark the house's purchase, but the cost of restoring it to its original condition, let alone to imagine a future for it, top out at an estimated $250,000. For those involved, it comes as a relief that the house is recognized as a treasure. The long work of making it look like one, though, is only just beginning. In the short term, though, all of this is resulting in a flurry of Simone's activity in the Triangle. August 16th to 18th, NCMA hosts Nina Simone Weekend, with several events anchored to a performance by Simone's daughter, Lisa Simone, and crafts No Fear in Blues Long Gone, Nina Simone, an updated version of his playing Rabin, will run August 21st to 25th at Keenan Theater. Both events are part of Come Here, North Carolina's broader commemorative event effort. On Friday, August the 16th, What Happened, Miss Simone? A documentary produced by Lisa Simone screens at NCMA in conjunction with a performance by Duke professor and dance artist Thomas DeFrance's experimental dance troupe, Slippage. Saturday's NCMA events include two masterclasses on Simone's lesser-known works and her contributions as a composer. Saturday evening, the Paris-based Lisa Simone will perform in the outdoor amphitheater, accompanied by local big band ensemble, the Tribe Jazz Orchestra. Lisa Simone is the only child of Nina Simone and, like her mother, is a renowned vocalist with Grammy nominations and numerous Broadway credits to her name. She closes the celebration out on Sunday with an intimate discussion of her mother's work. Nina Simone has made such an impact on so many women of color throughout the country. Being able to put this together with her daughter has been such an honor, says Carly Jones, who spearheaded the weekend alongside Angela Thorpe, director at the North Carolina African American Commission. The whole thing that we were planning this, we had Young, Gifted, and Black as our theme song. August 21st to 25th brings No Fear and Blues Long Gone, Nina Simone, directed by Catherine Hunter Williams for Playmakers. The one-woman play melds biography with speculation about how Simone would have responded to our times. It's an updated version of Kraft's Nina Simone, What More Can I Say?, which was commissioned in 2012 by Sonia B. Haynes Stone Center for Black Culture and History and ran for one season. In the 7 years since, Kraft and Rabin have kept up their prolific individual output, with Kraft teaching and writing plays, while Rabin has put out 3 albums, toured, and starred in numerous area theater productions. Both characterize the review's production as almost entirely new. When we did it before, we didn't have a big budget. We were creating on the fly, Rabin said. Over the course of the years, Howard has done something amazing to the script, and we have the resources, we have music, we have a set. Of course, the years since 2012 have also seen the election of Donald Trump and a marked shift in political discourse and violence. When it comes to the question of how Nina Simone, an artist who always saw America for what it was, would respond to our times, the material is almost infinite. Simone's talent was discovered early thanks to her performances as a toddler at her mother's church. The Triad community pooled money for piano lessons. By the age of 17, she moved to New York City to take lessons at the Juilliard School. Afterwards, she was hired to play piano in a dingy nightclub in Atlantic City, New Jersey, where she began performing under the name Nina Simone in order to disguise the gig from her minister mother, who disapproved of popular music. Popular music, though, approved of Nina Simone, and she was able to make an early career, that is, to survive, by performing breezy beloved pop standards like I Love You Porgy and My Baby Just Cares For Me. The civil rights movement, particularly the 1963 bombing of a Birmingham church, in which 4 little girls were murdered, shook her into penning the anguished anthem, Mississippi Goddamn. A long career of raw political music and activism would follow that dirge. Simone had always been responsive to injustice. During a performance at a local library at age 11, young Eunice saw her parents being removed from their seats in order to make room for a white couple. She responded by stating that she would not play until her parents were given back their seats. It was an effective protest. Her parents were returned to their seats. But a life that requires such an erring vigilance takes a toll. There is a particularly poignant moment of archival footage in What Happened, Miss Simone, in which an interview asks Simone if it's the role of an artist to alert America to the need for change. Without skipping a beat, Simone responds, "It's my role, but sometimes I wish it wasn't. You see, I have to live with Nina, and that is very difficult." If you look to Spotify for contemporary metrics, Simone's most popular song by thousands of listeners is her 1965 covering of Feeling Good. In her hands, Feeling Good is an idea, and an elastic one at that. The idea alone contains at least 50 distinct feelings. It's dynamic and cellular and elegant and personal. One thing it might not be called is intimate, because intimacy suggests an easy way in. Simone's pain is a reservoir located deep inside of her. Her delivery of certain lines of "Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood," a song written by her for her, although it was spurred dozens of unsatisfying covers, is breathless. Her voice so low it seems almost to be skimming the ocean floor. But then it swells upward in a charged plea. "I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please, don't let me be misunderstood." The husky, loaded pauses between each line are a painful magic. It is telling that both Lisa Simone's documentary and the original version of Kraft's play are titled with questions. For someone who offered so much of herself, Simone is still in many ways an elusive figure. Her struggles with mental illness and domestic violence didn't fully come to light until her death in 2003, when many people are still unaware of her roots in Western North Carolina. But audiences have always wanted to better understand who she is. Recognizing the place where she came into herself is one of the closing a gap between Simone's public and private lives. It also continues her tireless activism. The future function of the house is still up in the air, although whole community workshops have been held to try and answer the question. The consensus is that it will resemble, as closely as possible, the actual home she grew up in. One eye being floated is to have the house used as a space for artist residences. The story of the house is, after all, the story of artists of color who have vowed to protect it. Jones a joke that "To Be Young, Gifted, and Black," a song that Nina Simone composed in memory of her friend Lorraine Hansberry and performed for the first time in 1969, has been the unofficial theme song as she and Thorpe have worked on putting Nina Simone Weekend together. The song also proved symbolic for Raven. When she stepped into Simone's house for the first time last June, a piano was sitting in the front room. Propped on it was the sheet music for "To Be Young, Gifted, and Black." "I just stepped in the house and was like, oh God, to have been in a space where she walks," Raven said. "And that piece, I grew up with that, and that inspired me to keep on trying to be the best I could, because someday told me that it was good and beautiful to be young, gifted, and black." We now turn to the indie food section. Nikki had a little lamb. Bodega overcomes tapas fatigue, but good luck if you're a vegetarian. It's no secret that tapas has fully interpolated itself into global dining culture. In many ways, this has been a delightful turn of events, as creative small plates have come to dominate the restaurant landscape. Concurrently, tapas, the Spanish custom of making a meal out of small, quickly prepared plates, has become ubiquitous in the past decade, certainly in the Triangle, where it's often used to glamorize certain restaurant concepts. It's this buzzwordiness, tapas fatigue maybe, that puts Bodega at a potential disadvantage. An unfair disadvantage, because there's perhaps no purer representation of the form available than what is currently on offer from this six-month-old Wake Forest eatery. Other local restaurants strive to innovate the small plate into daring avant-garde permutations. But eating at Bodega is more akin to bar hopping in Madrid. A cavalcade of simple bites arrive almost instantly from a bustling kitchen, best enjoyed over good wine and loud conversation. On a recent visit, the first dish to come through the happy din of Bodega's shadowy dining room was a plate of piquillo peppers stuffed with North Carolina crab. It's perhaps the most Spanish dish on the menu, despite the provenance of the seafood. The peppers, lightly smoky and springly al dente, Enfold a generous scoop of crab salad, zippy and bright, with lemon mayonnaise. There were a few remnants of crab shell in the mix, which only made eating it feel closer to the source. We moved on to an empanada, stuffed with a beefy picadillo ingeniously sweetened by plantain. For some reason, I'm often prone to the world's worst empanadas, but bodegas were nearly perfect. The spiced, meaty filling was comforting and hearty, pastry so flaky and tender that it just barely started to soak up juices at the bottom. Bodega's menu is very meat and seafood focused. I admit I can be unsympathetic to the plight of vegetarians, but the lack of options here was striking even to me. If you err on the side of vegetarianism, be prepared to consume a lot of cheeses and starch, and be sure to inquire about removing the sundry pieces of cured pork that sneak into many of those dishes. I skipped the menu's lone salad, an underwhelming scatter of raw baby kale that robbed me about as much as a store-bought plastic tub would. More troubling and baffling, considering our fecund landscape and the beautiful time of year, was the nearly total absence of local seasonal vegetables. Not a single dish was driven by a North Carolina summer. That means no eggplant, peas, butter beans, okra, squash, zucchini, and for God's sakes, no tomatoes. To be fair, Bodega is a young restaurant. The chef de cuisine, Doug Seeley, is a transplant from Napa Valley. It takes time to establish relationships with local farmers, and it's always a challenge to source the best. Given that Seeley hails from a produce-driven part of the country, I'd hope that skill will eventually steer him toward the local harvests of the South. For now, let's take Bodega's surf and turf menu at face value because it yields some pretty spectacular results. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program has been intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And a reminder, this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.